All right, so how's lecture going? Peachily? Okay, how soon do you have an exam, by the way? Is it still a ways off? Well, February will be here before you know it. But let's talk about what we're doing here tonight. Really, I could have put on my website that you could have waited until next week for the Hardy Weinberg printout, but it's better to be early than late, so we're not actually going to talk about that tonight. What you're doing is the other handout, or the other thing that you should have printed, which is the PCR experiment. And I just want to give you a little bit of background about PCR itself. What am I talking about, first of all? What is PCR? It's the polymerase chain reaction, which is actually kind of an old technique now in terms of your lifetime. It's been around for a while, but it has really changed things as far as using DNA for various things is concerned. What does PCR accomplish? No matter what it's used for, what does it accomplish? Getting DNA? Replicating DNA, and therefore PCR is an amplification process. The greatest thing about PCR is that you can have a very, very tiny amount of DNA, whatever your sample is from or whatever it's for, you can have just barely any. And if you subject that tiny amount to PCR in just a little bit of time, especially now that it's all automated in a little machine, you'll have basically as many copies of that DNA as you want. So it allows you to amplify DNA, copying it exactly, so that you have enough of whatever DNA you're interested in to work with for whatever purpose. You know, for a lot of things, you're going to need enough DNA to work with. And that includes actually the second part, which we'll do next time, of this. What are we doing next time, by the way? What are we doing with the DNA that we amplify tonight? Would have been a good quiz question. Yeah, we're going to electrophorese it. I'll talk more about electrophoresis next time when we actually do that. But in order to get good results for electrophoresis, you need enough DNA to work with. You might not be able to extract that much DNA from the source, whatever it is. So PCR comes to the rescue and copies it for you. Now, PCR is an in vitro technique, meaning that it's done in tubes. So it's done in chemical solution, but it really mimics what is naturally done inside cells. Now, what are the two major jobs of DNA, by the way? DNA has two major functions in the body. What are they? This is straight from 181. Now, I know that at least one of 24 people knows at least one function of DNA. DNA doesn't directly make proteins. It's involved in the process of making proteins often, yes. But what is the part of the protein synthesis process that DNA is directly involved in? Well, it's the process that produces mRNA, which is what? What process? Transcription. That's one of the two answers I'm looking for. One of DNA's jobs. What is the other job? No, translation is not the other job of DNA. DNA has nothing to do with translation. Translation involves messenger RNA, which is produced by transcription. DNA's job at that point is done. So what else besides standing as a code for how to make RNA, which is what transcription is DNA good for? Now, I could go out on the street and ask children this question, and a lot of them will get the answer, so don't overthink it. What does DNA do? Well, it makes up your genes, and genes are used for transcription. But if you ask a kid, because DNA is so famous now even kids know about it, what do they say DNA is for? It gets passed on, right? It's part of heredity. But biologically speaking, in order for DNA to be passed on, it needs to undergo a process so that it can be passed on to two cells that come from one cell. Right? When cells are created, nowadays they no longer just pop into existence. All cells come from pre-existing cells. And so replication is the other answer. One cell splits into two cells. In order for both of those cells to have a full amount of DNA in them, the original cell has to first replicate the DNA so that there are two copies, one for each of the two cells that it's going to split into. All right? So self-replication and transcription are the two jobs of DNA. PCR replicates, basically mimics the DNA replication process that occurs in cells. Okay? It does it in a slightly different way, but it takes advantage of DNA's ability to copy itself. Why is it that DNA is able to make exact copies of itself? What feature of DNA is perfectly suited for it to be able to know how to copy itself? Well, DNA is built how? What kind of nucleic acid is it? DNA and RNA are both nucleic acids. But DNA is a nucleic acid that is double-stranded, whereas most RNAs are single-stranded, right? What do you know about the two strands that make up one DNA molecule? They form a double helix. That's a geometric consideration. But what is the relationship between one strand and the other within one DNA molecule? Can't hear you. They are complementary to each other, exactly, which means whatever the code is on one strand is exactly the complement, or roughly opposite, of what the code is on the other strand. By complementarity rules, I'm talking about the fact that T, thymine, always binds at the same location but on the other strand with what other nucleotide? A, adenine, and C always with G. That's the complementarity rules. So if you have a double-stranded DNA molecule and you remove one of those strands and don't let me look at it, I can tell you exactly what the sequence is by looking at the sequence in the other one and just saying T wherever A is here, T A wherever T is, C wherever G is, G wherever C is. That's complementarity. So in the replication process, the two strands are separated from each other so that each one can serve as a template for how to make a copy of the other one. And if that's done for each of the two strands, what you end up with then are two double-stranded DNA molecules that are identical to each other, one for each of the two cells. Right? PCR does that, only not inside cells, but inside test tubes, PCR tubes. There are three major steps in this PCR process, but each step is one of three steps in a cycle, and then there are multiple cycles in the entire process. So each cycle, however many you program the machine, which is called a thermal cycler, to accomplish, there are three steps in each cycle. All right? Anyone know the names of those from having read the handout? The names of the steps for each cycle? The first one is called denaturation. What in general does denaturation refer to? For instance, you can denature a protein. You can also denature DNA. Denaturation refers to destroying the shape of, basically, or the integrity of. For a protein, denaturing means misfolding it, so it doesn't have its shape. And for protein, shape is everything because shape determines function. For DNA, denaturation refers to separating the two strands within one double-stranded helix from each other. It does not refer to disassembling the nucleotides that make up one strand. Okay? That's important because if you separate all the nucleotides from each other, all you have is a pile of nucleotides and you have no idea what the code was originally. But if you simply separate the two strands from each other, you still have two intact codes, each of which tells you what the other code is. All right? In the natural process, in a cell, denaturation takes place enzymatically. There's an enzyme responsible for separating the two strands. What is that enzyme? Can't hear you. Anyone know the enzyme? This is all still 181 stuff. It's not polymerase. Polymerase builds new polynucleotides. The enzyme responsible for separating the two strands in a cell is called helicase, named for the fact that it separates the two strands of the helix, or corkscrew shape. All right? Well, we're not going to use an enzyme to do that job in the PCR process. Instead, we use heat. If you raise the temperature high enough, DNA will denature. The two strands will separate from each other, but each strand will still be intact. You won't separate the nucleotides from each other, just the strands from each other. And that's because the bonds that hold the nucleotides together along one strand are much stronger than the bonds that hold two strands together. What type of bonds hold two strands together? Hydrogen bonds, yes, very weak. What type of bonds hold nucleotides together to form the overall sequence? Well, there are covalent bonds, which are very strong bonds. They're specifically called phosphodiester bonds. You might have learned that, but they're covalent, so they're very strong. Therefore, if you get the temperature high enough, it's high enough so that the very weak hydrogen bonds get disrupted, and therefore the two strands separate from each other, but it's not so high that you break one strand into individual nucleotides and lose the code. All right? So PCR uses heat to do the job of helicase, which is denaturation, the first of three steps in a cycle. Now, you can't do DNA, I mean, you can't do polymerase PCR, polymerase chain reaction, unless you first know what you're looking for. So you not only have to have some sample DNA, but you have to know what that sample DNA is so that you can look for a certain sequence within the overall long DNA molecule. The DNA molecule is much longer than the part within that that you're interested in. And so an overall double strand has some subset of its length that you're interested in, say from here to here. You have to know that going into it, and you have to know what the sequence is of nucleotides at the beginning and at the end of that sequence of interest. Because you then have to design your experiment so that the mixture of chemicals you use in the process includes a complementary sequence that will recognize the beginning or the end of that overall DNA sequence you're interested in. Okay? Well, that has to do with the second step, which is called annealing. Annealing refers to two pieces of complementary DNA forming hydrogen bonds. In other words, going back together. So, just by chance, the two strands that have just been separated in the previous step, the denaturation, they could go right back together. You really don't want that to happen, though. It will to a certain, at a certain frequency. But really what you want to happen is have your little pieces of DNA that recognize the start and end of your sequence of interest, you want those to go and anneal to the corresponding places on the separated strands. All right? Before I forget, though, I meant to mention that in denaturation, I didn't forget anything. So annealing refers to the binding of primers, those little pieces of DNA that you have to have by the billions in your mixture. Those finding their complementary spots within your sample DNA is annealing. So this little red thing is a primer. Now, in the cell, you use primers as well. But they're different. What is the primer made of in a cell as the first part of DNA replication? You have to lay down a primer before you can then make it longer. What's the primer made out of in a cell? No one? It's made out of RNA, not DNA. Even though you're trying to make a DNA molecule, cells don't have the ability to put DNA nucleotides down unless there's already some nucleotides there to build on. So you can't form that first foundation out of DNA. You have to use RNA. And that's why cells do that, and then they put DNA nucleotides one by one on that RNA primer. But then, since it's RNA and not DNA, the primer, the cell has to go back after that process and replace the RNA with DNA. Have to replace the primers with DNA. We don't have to bother with that step in PCR because we use DNA primers designed into our specific application of PCR instead of RNA. Okay? So these red things are the DNA primers that we put in our mix. They recognize the beginning, which will be on one strand, and the end, which will be on the other strand, of the overall sequence we care about in our sample. Okay? Everyone have that? Is that a yes? All right. Tell me if it's not, if you don't. The final step of each cycle is elongation. And this happens just like it does in the cell, meaning that an enzyme is responsible for one by one adding a nucleotide to the end of the growing strand. So that primer gets elongated by one nucleotide, and then you put another nucleotide on that, and so on. An enzyme does that job in the cell. What's that enzyme called? That's the one someone guessed. What is that enzyme? DNA polymerase, yes. It's called polymerase because by stringing together nucleotides, you're forming what is called a polymer. So polymerization is the job of polymerase. DNA is a polymer. All right? Now, in tonight's exercise, we're going to use PCR to amplify human DNA, right? Your own DNA. And, of course, your cells have their own DNA polymerase that work very well for replicating your own DNA every time one of your cells splits into two cells. That's happening throughout your lifetime, right? Whenever you make the billions of new red blood cells that you make every day, for instance, or skin cells or whatever kind of cells you're making. But we don't use human polymerase in the PCR process, in this thermal cycler, even though we're trying to make human DNA. Why can't we use human polymerase for this job? Works fine in the cell, will not work in this process. Why? Any idea at all? Consider the what we've already talked about as the previous steps. So obviously, since human polymerase works perfectly well in a cell, it must be because of something we're doing differently compared to the cell in one of the earlier processes. What's the problem? What are we doing differently from a cell that I've already discussed? What is it? That is one difference, but that's not the reason polymerase won't work. What's the first difference? What I started talking about. The very first difference between what happens in a cell and what happens in PCR. What's the job of helicase? Separate the strands. We don't do that, right? We don't use helicase. How do we separate the strands? Heat. What's the problem? Why can't we use polymerase? Because heat not only denatures DNA, it denatures proteins. What is polymerase? It's an enzyme, right? ASE ending tells you it's an enzyme. What kind of chemicals are enzymes? Proteins. If you get them too hot, they'll unfold. They'll no longer have the correct shape. An enzyme that doesn't have the right shape is no longer a working enzyme. So we would destroy, even if we did have polymerase in there from a human, we would destroy it before its job ever came up to be due. We would destroy it in the very first step, denaturation, because that happens at very high temp. Okay, so the denaturation step in the thermal cycler happens because the thermal cycler goes to very high temp temporarily. Then it goes down in temperature so the other steps can happen. But by then, the damage to human polymerase, or just about any polymerase, no matter what organism you get it from, would have been destroyed. So the key to making this process, which was invented a while ago, work, was finding in nature an organism whose polymerase enzymes can stand up to such high heat. So they looked for organisms that live naturally in places that are very hot. Organisms that live at those extreme temperatures are called thermophiles, meaning that they love high temperature, they love heat. So they found a bacterium that lives in Yellowstone at the temperature of boiling water, and its polymerase just loves being at the temperature that we put the denaturation step at in a PCR machine. And therefore we use that kind of polymerase, or another kind, there's multiple kinds that have been discovered, but that the most famous one of those is called TAC polymerase, T-A-Q. T-A-Q simply is an abbreviation for Thermophilus aquaticus, which is the genus and species of the bacterium that they got it from. But that TAC polymerase, that stands up to the heat. Okay? The polymerase reads the code in the blue strand and then figures out by complementarity rules what the appropriate nucleotide is to add to the primer, making it longer and longer. So that's going to happen for as long as you allow it to happen, meaning for as long as temperature is low enough. Okay, this one recognized a sequence, either the start or the beginning, on one strand, and it's going to grow as long as you will let it grow in this direction. At the same time, the other kind of primer, the beginning or the end, depending on what you call it, found a sequence on the other strand. These two blue ones are complementary to each other. And it's going to build a new strand going in this direction for as long as you let it. What you really want to do, though, is stop growing at the other end of the sequence you're interested in, right? It's not going to know when to stop, though. So it will elongate for as long as you allow it to, which is however long you program it to in that first elongation step within cycle one. The very next cycle, everything gets repeated. So it'll jump up in temperature, and that high temp will no longer allow elongation. It'll stop that process. Okay? So it'll grow for however long it does, and that will be a little bit too long, actually. And when it heats again, everything comes apart. They're all single strands. So now you have this green one that's a little bit too long and a corresponding green one that's complementary to it that's a little bit too long. But when this is now used, I mean, during the next annealing cycle, the other kind of primer will be complementary to the other end on this green strand that you care about. Okay? So you see that happening right here. It binds here and then moves this way, and it will only go to the end because it can't go past where there's no DNA to read. So this little sequence is exactly the right length from beginning to end. And similarly on this one, it found this part and it goes all the way to the end, which is the starting point. All right? The key to this being such a successful process for multiplication, for amplification, is that DNA replication doubles the amount of DNA every cycle, right? In a normal cell, you only do it once per cell division because you only need two copies. In a PCR machine, you do it however many times you program it to, typically about 40 cycles. Well, you still don't have much DNA after that first cycle. All you've doubled it, and all you've done is doubling it, which isn't much if you started with a tiny amount. But after 40 cycles, if everything went right, you have 2 to the 40th power times as much DNA as you started with. 2 to the 40th power, 2 times 2 times 2, 40 times, is a hell of a big number. So you'll have billions of copies of DNA for each copy that you had originally, as long as you have enough raw materials in your tubes to start with. Those raw materials are all the nucleotides, trillions of copies of A, C, T, and G, billions of copies of the primers, so that they can keep being used. You know, each time you go through a cycle, you need twice as many primers because you have twice as many strands now that can recognize those primers. And then some other chemical things that make things happen nice and happily. But those are the real big things as far as DNA is concerned, the primers and the nucleotides. Okay? So that's the whole idea. After you go through a few cycles, you're still always going to be making some of these slightly longer than desired strands. But after you get the first strand that's exactly the right length, it's going to be copied perfectly, and therefore each cycle is going to have a higher and higher percentage of the overall DNA that's produced be exactly the right length and just a few stragglers that are longer. Well, by the time you get to 2 to the 40th power, even if you have several thousand pieces of that are too long, that's effectively zero compared to the billions of exactly the right length segments that you have. Okay? So that's what we're dealing with, and that's mostly what I wanted to talk about. This is going to be your first test on how well you can follow instructions, because I'm not going to go through what you're actually doing. That's what the protocol is for. I'm here to help you, of course, if you run into trouble, but don't just immediately say, what do we have to do? Read the thing, discuss it as a group. You're working in fours, two across from two, and your materials are within the little plastic hinged box. This is enough for each group of four. So you do it just once for each group of four, okay? There's a couple slight changes, so make note of this. I don't know whether this is so much a change, this first one, or as a clarification. When it talks about using solution A, which is in your little box, you really have to transfer the prescribed amount, the prescribed volume of A to a new tube, which is also in there. So you use an empty tube. That's the one that you label with your group's name, whatever it is. You put the correct amount of A into that tube. You don't just use the whole tube of A. All right? I'm sorry. You're working individually, but you have enough A for each individual in the group is what I meant to say. All right, that's one thing. I think that's the only change that you have to care about. The rest of it is stuff I need to do. So your master mix is not yet ready. I'll make that while you get started, and then I'll come around and allow you to use it. Notice these volumes that you're using. 10 microliters is a tiny amount of volume, tiny amount of liquid. So you need to know how to properly micropipette. And graduating seniors often get this wrong, so I'm going to bother to tell you. I didn't go over pipetting before, did I? On a micropipette, these are used for transferring very tiny liquids. First of all, there are different kinds. This isn't the one to use. Make sure you're using the lowest volume one. They're listed on the side. Okay? This one is the 10 to 100 microliter range, but you're supposed to use the even lower one. Anyway, what people get wrong is the plunging aspect of this. What you do is, first of all, you put a tip onto it by not touching the tip. Wear gloves the whole time tonight, by the way. But you just put this into the top of the tip, which is in your tip boxes. These contain your tips. There's different kinds of tips, so use the right ones. Anyway, you don't really have to jam it on too hard. That's another error. It will make a good seal just if you lightly press it onto the tip. If you put it on too hard, when you use the ejection button to get the tip off later, there will be so much friction that the whole thing will come apart. Springs will fly. You don't want to do that. Don't break the pipetters. You can dial in the volume that you want to transfer just by turning this, okay? But the most important thing to do is to plunge it correctly, and you have to notice that there are two stops when you plunge this. There's a soft stop that will naturally stop at, but if you use enough force, you can press through that, okay? So a soft stop and a hard stop all the way. If you go all the way down to the hard stop and then suck up what you're trying to transfer, you've taken more than you've dialed in. Okay? So dial it in correctly. 10 microliters for you. Have the tip on. Push it down just to the soft stop and keep it there. Put it under the surface of the liquid. Then just release your thumb. That will suck up exactly what you've dialed in. Then when you take it to whatever other vessel you're going to deliver it into, push all the way, and that additional amount of air will make sure you've gotten rid of all the liquid from your tip. Okay? Do that correctly, because following these instructions very carefully and doing all the times exactly the correct amount of time and at the right temperature is important. I'm going to add water to this heat block. These are all. This metal is already at 95 centigrade. That's centigrade, not Fahrenheit, so don't touch it like I just did. But I'm going to put some water in here so that when you put a tube in there, it will get better conduction. Any other questions, let me know. I'm going to leave you to do it now.